This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Organized labor has definitely seen better days. What Italians think of our economic problems, not much, is the answer. And rising inequality in the land of opportunity. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 6th of June. Glad you could be with us. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is still Governor Walker today. He fended off a recall challenge last night and in the process pushed back pretty hard against organized labor. That was the root cause of the recall, as you'll remember. Walker's eventually successful effort to limit collective bargaining rights for public sector workers as a way to control spending, he said. States, of course, aren't the only ones that see labor as a place to cut costs. Companies do it all the time. There are layoffs and buyouts and all that stuff. And we're starting to see companies offering retirees buyouts because their pension costs are too high. General Motors, GM, is offering lump sum payments to 42,000 white-collar retirees, a sign some fear of things to come. From New York, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith starts us off.
When it comes to retired workers, General Motors is on the hook for $134 billion. That's the biggest pension obligation of any U.S. company. The buyout plan will cut that by about 20%. Wharton professor Kent Smetters says the buyout is expensive in the short run.
The advantage is that they get more certainty.
Certainty that pension plans stop weighing on profits. Company pensions are chronically underfunded, and when the economy's bad, it's harder to find cash to fill the gap.
We're pretty close to the worst point that we've been at since we've been measuring this.
John Barry is a partner at Mercer Consulting Firm, which just completed a pension study. Turns out in May, company pension funds in the U.S. were nearly $500 billion short.
These are big plans, and they've got a lot of work cut out for them over the next few years to deal with these deficits.
Barry says other companies are likely to follow GM and Ford's example and offer buyouts. What does that mean for workers?
A lot more financial responsibility.
Zvi Bodhi teaches finance and investing at Boston University. He says, unlike the companies, retirees will take on more risk and have to manage their retirement money themselves.
At Boston University, we currently have literally over 100 different investment choices. I teach the subject of investments, and I wouldn't be able to readily solve the problem of what to select.
GM is offering financial counseling to retirees affected by the change. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There's some new research out today about education and how much you make. A study from Georgetown University says that if you have what's called a post-secondary certificate, you'll earn 20% more than somebody with just a high school diploma. Over a lifetime, that adds up to nearly $250,000 more. But women with certificates aren't earning nearly as much as men are. From the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk, Shireen Marisol Meraji reports.
I like it longer.
So that means
we can
not touch it?
Cut the sides a little and then we can see.
My name is Jessica Arnold and I am a hairstylist.
Jessica Arnold grew up in a college town, Ann Arbor, Michigan.
I felt like I was surrounded by college students and a majority of my clients were college students.
But college wasn't for Arnold. She always knew she wanted to do hair and says her parents were encouraging.
I don't think they were college people either. My dad was a business owner, and he didn't go to college, so.
A lot of certificates that females tend to get are dead-end. Healthcare tends to be that way, frankly, as does cosmetology.
Anthony Carnevale directs the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce. He conducted the certificate study and says Arnold's earnings are likely to stay stagnant, totally different for men.
The lowest earning certificate that's dominated by men pays more than the highest earning certificate for women.
And if you're a man in a high earning category, like computers or engineering, you're more likely to go back to college and get a degree. I didn't have to look too far to find a real-life example. Marketplace IT guru Steve Turzo is a Cisco-certified network associate, and he already makes $60,000 a year.
Do you want to go back to college?
Yep.
To do what?
I don't know, study computer science, something like that.
Georgetown's Carnevale says if he was giving female members of his family advice, he'd tell them to follow Turzo's lead and not stop at a certificate. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
Big doings just down Figueroa Street from us at the Staples Center here in Los Angeles tonight. Game four, possibly the last game, fingers crossed, of the Stanley Cup Finals. The Los Angeles Kings versus the New Jersey Devils. If the Kings win, it's going to be the first Stanley Cup championship in Kings history ever. Only problem for fans, though, even nosebleed seats are going to set you back almost $1,000. And Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports just watching the game on TV is going to cost you two.
Here's Williams, breakaway pass, Anze Kopitar scores!
If hockey fans want to watch their teams battle for the sport's biggest prize on TV tonight, they'll have to pay. The game's only on a cable channel called NBC Sports Network.
This is somewhat of a vexing issue.
The Wharton School's Scott Rossner.
Because NBC Sports Network is not what we call fully distributed in the United States.
NBCSN reaches nearly 80 million homes, but that still leaves another 40 million or so up a creek without a hockey pedal. I mean, stick. Lee Burke, CEO of LHB Sports Entertainment and Media, says get used to it, sports fans.
More games are migrating over to cable. In return, they're receiving substantial increases in rights fees, which help finance the performance of a well-performing team like the Kings.
Like top-notch players and fancy arenas. But don't hockey and other pro sports care about cutting off the fans who can't afford those pricey cable channels? John Orand covers TV and media for Sports Business Journal.
Ironically, when sports go to cable, the average viewer actually gets much younger. So this is actually a way that sports leagues have used to get younger and to be more attractive to advertisers and bring in more money.
Modern-day sports fans, get ready to pony up. And for all you hockey lovers without NBC Sports Network tonight, Wharton's Scott Rossner has a suggestion. Do what he used to do when he was a kid following the Philadelphia Flyers. Listen to the game on radio. Now, there's an idea. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Radio? I don't know. On Wall Street today, European debt crisis? What European debt crisis? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's been said before, and it bears saying again, the biggest banks on Wall Street, the ones that helped bring us the economy of the past 4 years, the ones that were too big to fail, are even bigger now. J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, those guys. And while she was chairwoman of the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, Sheila Bair tried hard and succeeded to some degree in getting regulators to follow up on what she regards as a key weakness in the American financial industry, systemic risk, that one failure that's going to bring everything else down with it. Ms. Bair is now out of government, but still worried about systemic risk. She's starting up a new watchdog group called the Systemic Risk Council to apply a little public pressure. Sheila Bair, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Without putting words in your mouth, I wonder if we could define systemic risk as banking arrogance. And I know that's a loaded term.
Oh, well, I think certainly
there was probably a lot of hubris leading up to the crisis with both bank managers and, frankly, some regulators as well. I think banks got it's not just banks. I want to say financial institutions, because a lot of this was going on in what we call the shadow sector. It wasn't being done by the traditional banks that take deposits and make loans. It was being done by investment banks and insurance companies like AIG and others. So I do think that that needs to be clarified. But if the risk-taking is such that when the losses occur, it's going to hurt innocent bystanders among the general public, then that's when a systemic action needs to be taken.
Doesn't it say something, though, that you, as one of the most senior banking regulators when you were inside the government, now feels it necessary to, from your position outside the government, weigh in on this? I mean, what are we to make of the fact that you, as the former chairwoman of the FDIC, doesn't think we're doing enough?
Well, it is distressing to me. Amnesia set in pretty quickly after the 2008 crisis, and this concerned me. But I do think perhaps we can provide more encouragement for that kind of leadership, being a voice for good regulatory policy and coordinating and prioritizing and making sure the rules are cohesive and simple and explaining them to the public and communicating the reforms that are being undertaken.
In a nutshell, if I might, this Systemic Risk Council will try to use the power of public persuasion, really, to get regulators concentrating on systemic risk. Is that the basic idea?
That is correct, because at the end of the day, with all this lobbying, and the financial institutions, they're just representing their own economic interest, and that's I accept that that's what they do, but it's the government's job to protect the public interest.
Do you think the government and regulators are serving the public interest right now?
I think they're trying, but I think the process itself is not working well.
On the theory that you are someone who is kept up at night by fears of systemic risk, what does that look like for you? What are you afraid of?
I think Europe is the big question mark, and there's a lot of derivatives interconnectedness there, and I don't think anybody really understands how that would play out. So I think that's one of the reasons why, and I tell banks when I hear them, or other financial institutions when I hear them lobbying against stronger capital standards and other regulatory reforms, I wish instead of being in Washington trying to water down reforms, they would be concentrating on bolstering their balance sheets, raising capital reserves, making sure that they're ready if something bad happens in Europe. I hope it will not, and I keep being told that at the 11th hour, the European governments will get their act together and resolve this, but I haven't seen it so far.
Sheila Bair, she is a former chairwoman of the FDIC. She is now a senior advisor to the Pew Charitable Trusts and the chairwoman of the Systemic Risk Council. Ms. Bair, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
If you want to know more about systemic risk, our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore has just the thing for you. It's an explainer called, "Hey Brother, Can You Spare $500 Billion for America's Banks?" It's on our website, marketplace.org. President Obama is in Los Angeles today. It's a fundraising trip, so yeah, he's going to be in Beverly Hills. No surprise there. But he's also going to be in the Black Beverly Hills. It's a part of L.A. known as View Park. And we aired a story last week from our Wealth and Poverty Desk about the neighborhood. Generally, you liked it. But this comment right at the end of the piece by a woman who lives in View Park got some of you a little riled up.
I was telling all my neighbors, we have to all get out and vote. And not because he's Black, but... Well, yes, it is because he's Black. I'm not going to tell a lie.
That didn't sit well with Luis Gonzalez from Port St. Lucie, Florida.
It seemed the people of View Park were rightfully so very proud of him going there. It just struck me that I don't agree with the premise that we should vote for a candidate simply because they're Hispanic, Black, white, whatever race might be.
Mr. Gonzalez did go on to say that his own race isn't going to be a deciding factor in his vote this fall. As part of that piece on View Park, we asked for your help in defining what it means to be middle class by sending us a picture. And here's just one of the ones that we got.
It's a photo of my daughter picking out a couple of small gourds that she's going to take home.
That's Lorraine Gonzalez of Sacramento. Small gourds is what she said. She's the daughter, Ms. Gonzalez says, of migrant farm workers.
My father went to college and was able to provide a more comfortable lifestyle for me. I, too, wanted to go to college, and I knew that if I had children as well, I would be able to provide for them and have them live a bit more of a comfortable life.
Which is, one imagines, what every parent wants. What we want are your pictures of what it means to you to be middle class. Post them at marketplace.org or on our Facebook page. Coming up, this is the land of opportunity, right? Maybe not for everybody.
We have less opportunity than not only the countries of old Europe, but any of the advanced industrial countries.
But first, let's do the numbers. Investors built a rally on hope today, speculating that central bankers in the U.S. and Europe might open the spigot soon on the stimulus app. The Dow Industrials jumped 286 points, 2.3%, 12,414. At the bell, the NASDAQ bounced 66 points, a little more than 2.3%, 2844. The S&P 500 rose 29 points, not quite 2.3%, 1315 is the number you're looking for. For the record, the stock market has now rebounded from the big decline back on June 1st with 3 days of gains, capping Wall Street's biggest rally so far this year. Financial shares got a big shot in the arm. Stock in Morgan Stanley surged 8%. Bank of America shares beefed up more than 7.5% today. Hovnanian Enterprises turned in strong quarterly profits, and the homebuilder stock soared 18%. Other housing-related stocks built on that. Pulte Group advanced more than 7% today. Bond prices sank. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.66%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Federal Reserve is scheduled to release consumer credit data for April. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee holds a hearing on the economy. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke testifies. And it's a bird. It's a plane. It's the 34th annual Superman celebration getting underway in Metropolis, Illinois. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know, it's not all fundraisers for the president this week, today's trip out here to L.A. notwithstanding. He's been on the phone with European leaders trying to get a handle on what's going on over there, as are we.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
What's up, Europe? Today to Italy, Turin to be precise, and Marco Bardazzi. He's the editor of La Stampa, one of Italy's main daily newspapers. Mr. Bardazzi, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
How's the mood in Italy these days with all the turmoil around you in Spain and Greece?
Well, the mood is bad because we see that the situation is not improving and there are a lot of problems all around Europe. We are really looking forward for a European meeting that is scheduled on June 28 in Brussels. We are looking at that as the possible turning point in the crisis, but we are not sure that this will happen.
Haven't we been at the turning point many times before, though?
Yes, you're right. We have hoped for several other turning points, so we don't know if this will be another whole hope for Europe. But really, it's a countdown to this meeting on June 28 that could decide what will happen of the euro and the European Union.
Do Italians ever look at the United States and say to themselves, man, you guys think you have troubles, but you don't know what you're talking about. This is really rough over here?
Yes, there is a strange feeling right now toward the United States. Some people think that the U.S. are those that have put us in trouble right now. At the same time, there are many others who think that from the United States we can see some signs of recovery and we don't have those signs here.
That was Marco Bardazzi. He's the editor of the newspaper La Stampa. We got him in Turin, Italy today. There are a few things that get American consumers more agitated than what they have to pay to drive around. And for that reason, I'm pleased to report that crude oil prices are off $20 or so from the beginning of the year, a welcome relief for consumers and our wallets. Our wallets and our purses are the inspiration behind Money Matters, our regular series on consumer finance, where today Marketplace's Scott Tong tells us what we might expect in our short-term driving future.
Remember the silly straw? You sucked on the big curvy thing and it took a little while for purple Kool-Aid to arrive? Same with gas prices. When crude oil prices fall, it takes a week or two to inch its way to the pump. Here's Avery Ash of AAA.
The cheaper crude is purchased by refiners, it's refined into gasoline, it's sold in the wholesale gasoline market, and then eventually makes its way to consumers.
He thinks gas prices will keep falling. By how much? The rule of thumb says for each dollar crude oil falls, gasoline comes down 2.5 cents. So last month's $20 drop in crude means about 50 cents a gallon less, and we're not there yet. And it could go down further still, if you listen to Phil Flynn at Price Futures Group. He says we're swimming in oil supply.
We have the most oil in the United States we've had since the 1990s. Europe's supplies are overwhelming. You've got OPEC producing the most oil they have in over 30 years.
And this may sound weird, but Flynn doesn't think the world has enough buyers to prop up oil prices. Not in Europe, not in Asia, not here. So that's kind of a bright spot in a dark and stormy world economy. Some more sunshine, cheap gas lightens other bills. Andrew Weissman is an energy lawyer at Haynes and Boone. He says cheaper oil-based fertilizer makes for cheaper food. Plus,
transportation costs are a particularly significant factor in the tomatoes you buy at the grocery store or almost any other food good.
He says lower-cost produce takes about a month to get to market. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We've been making the rounds of deep thinker economists this week. Paul Krugman on Monday, John Taylor out of Stanford yesterday, trying to get a sense of how the economy might fix what ails it. For some, though, the big problem isn't the economy, but what that economy has done to society, rising inequality, and how fast the gap is growing. Not just the gap between the rich and the poor, but between the super rich and everybody else. So today, another Nobel Prize-winning economist, Joseph Stiglitz. His new book is called The Price of Inequality. Joe Stiglitz, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So I hate to be the one to break this to you, but it's not like this is new news, right?
Well, it is new news in the following sense. Of course, we've always had inequality, but the magnitude of our inequality has actually increased dramatically. The fraction of the income that goes to the upper 1% has doubled since 1980. The fraction that goes to the upper 0.1% has almost tripled since 1980. So, yes, we've always had inequality, but not of this magnitude.
I'm going to quote yourself back to you here just in as a way to sort of crystallize your thoughts on this. Growing inequality, you say, is the flip side of something else, shrinking opportunity. Play that out a little bit, would you?
That's right. The United States has become the most unequal country among the advanced industrial countries. And some people said, oh, you know, we don't care about equality of outcome. What we really care about is equality of opportunity. America is a land of opportunity. We have less opportunity than not only the countries of old Europe, but any of the advanced industrial countries for which there's data. And what that means is very simple. The life chances of an individual are more dependent on the income and education of his parent than in other countries. And an implication of that is people born in the bottom, who unfortunately chose parents who were poor not well educated, will more likely not be able to live up to his potential.
You make no secret of how you feel about the 1% and their pursuit of remaining in the 1%. But doesn't it kind of imply actual malice on their part that they just want to stay rich while everybody else doesn't get rich?
I don't think anybody begrudges somebody who has made a real contribution to our society. Somebody, you know, that will invent the transistor or the laser or the computer, from receiving a high income. The real concern is a sense of unfairness, that it's not the case that the people who have the highest income have made the largest contribution to our society. You know, look at what happened in the Great Recession. And I think most Americans understand that there's something fundamentally unfair about that. Not only unfair, my concern is that it actually undermines the efficiency of our economy. They have incentives to behave in ways that impose costs on the rest of our society.
This is essentially a political position you're advancing here. You want to see certain things happen to change the rising inequality in this country.
Yes, and for a very special, particular reason, our political system has shaped our economy in ways that have led to this high level of inequality.
Right, and that gets me to my question, which is, you know politics in this country, and you know how intractable managing the American economy is. How and why do you believe that the Congress and political Washington are going to be able to do anything about this?
Well, we're going to need political reform. I raise the question, you know, is there hope? Mm. And I think the answer is, if you look historically, America has made some very dramatic changes. And so I'm hopeful that Americans will see what is going on, realize that the direction we've been going is not a good direction, and change. But I'm not confident.
Joe Stiglitz, he teaches at Columbia University. His most recent book is called The Price of Inequality. Thanks very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, a remembrance of Ray Bradbury, who died yesterday at 91. And you can't really just call Ray Bradbury a science fiction writer, more like social commentator, really, on our collective anxiety about what the future might bring. He is still best known for Fahrenheit 451, a book about book burning in a distant America. A couple of years ago, he talked to Queena Kim, our new tech reporter, about how that book came to be.
I was wandering around UCLA. I heard typing in the basement of the library, and there were 12 students typing for 10 cents a half hour. So I got a bag of diamonds.
Did you say you brought in a bag of diamonds?
Dimes. I moved into the typing room, and I wrote Fahrenheit 451 in 9 days.
$9.80 worth of dimes is what that book cost him. Fahrenheit 451, The Illustrated Man, The Martian Chronicles, and a whole lot more.
I'm a magician. I can make you believe anything that I tell you. I know how to live forever, so help me God.
Ray Bradbury passed away yesterday at the age of 91. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow bounced 286 points, 2.3%. The NASDAQ up 66 points, 2.3%. The S&P 500 gained 29 points, almost 2.3%. You'd think they'd arranged it or something. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Cologne, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.